You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Well, she has no plan for Syria, and look, with her, you'll end up in World War III. She doesn't know what she's doing. So you're not fighting Syria anymore. You're fighting Syria, Russia, and Iran.
Really, though? Is that really what she's trying to do? Is that really what would happen? At the risk of taking Donald Trump's assertion semi-seriously, how bad are things between the West and Russia? My guests George Brock and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the Czech Republic's plans for a counter-propaganda unit, the conundrum posed by Turkish diplomats seeking asylum in Germany, and the clamorous global rise of what Germans call the Wutbürger. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and George Brock, professor of journalism at City University London. Welcome both. And we will start in the United States, where the orange Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has made another of his measured and constructive outbursts, this time claiming that the Syria policy of his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton would prompt World War III. Whether or not Trump thinks this would be an entirely bad thing is unclear, but he does have half a point in that the imposition of a no-fly zone over Syria, as Clinton is suggesting, might well see American and Russian pilots regarding each other through missile sites. George, on this proposition first, the idea of a no-fly zone over Syria, is it actually unworkably reckless?
I think it probably is. I really hate to be giving much credence or seriousness to Donald Trump, but for once... and this may be the only occasion.
The broken clock right twice a day.
Exactly. I think he may just have a point. I don't think it rests on a very detailed or shrewd analysis by him. And let's also say he's not the only person to point out that trying to actually make practical a no-fly zone over Syria could be very dangerous.
Sebastian, isn't it the reality that whatever America thinks or wants to do over Syria or with Syria or about Syria, pretty much everybody but Russia has forfeited the initiative at this point, haven't they?
Well, you know, I wouldn't use the word reckless in talking about U.S. foreign policy or indeed the proposals of Hillary Clinton. Reckless, the only person having acted recklessly in this whole conflict over the years has been Vladimir Putin, and America has been extraordinarily restrained. In fact, you could argue much too restrained in lots of ways, particularly with the famous Obama red line about chemical weapons, which then turned out to be
not as red as advertised.
To turn out to be pink or whatever line it
sort
was.
Sort of cerise.
Indeed. So you know. What we're doing at the moment is we're searching desperately for some sort of solution. Reckless is sending off your fleet through the channel towards Syria. Reckless is bombing the hell out of the what is left of Aleppo. Reckless is propping up a totally discredited regime for your own very nationalistic aims. So, you know, I'm not buying that.
In light of all those points, George, that Sebastian raises, including such other developments as, well, most obviously interfering in Ukraine, seizing Crimea, more recently moving Iskander M missiles to Kaliningrad, is there anything in this quite popular current narrative that we are in a renewed Cold War or a new Cold War with Russia?
Well, we're certainly in a confrontation of tension with Russia, because that is Russia's wish. I'm not saying that there isn't going to come a point where some powers, probably led by or indeed only America, are going to have to confront the aggression of Russian power. I'm just not sure that the correct choice would be to do so in the air over Syria.
Sebastian, I think it's fair to say that everybody around this table is of sufficient vintage to remember the Cold War the first time round. Does this feel like the same sort of thing to you?
And can we go back to how the Cold War started? That was Russian Soviet aggression in that way, you know. And the Americans, after some hesitation, reacted with a containment designed by George Kennan. So it's interesting that we in the West sort of argue about the Cold War and seem to be blaming the Americans for something which is entirely Russia's fault. I mean, the great difference, of course, is that Russia is acting not out of the tremendous strength and national unity that they had at the end of the Second World War, after that terrible war which Germany had started, but out of weakness, and that makes it in a way more dangerous. And I have to say, if I look at Putin and Trump, I think that the probability of a Third World War in whatever form, with Trump in the White House and Putin in the Kremlin, is much higher than with Hillary Clinton in the White House and Putin in the Kremlin.
George, Sebastian there raised the spectre of red lines drawn in Syria in this instance, but is it arguable that the West has not been sufficiently firm in drawing, similar shaded lines where Russia is concerned? Have we allowed Russia to get away with too much in the last 2 years? And I guess the inevitable follow-up to that is, what could we have done to stop them?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to think what the West could have done, for example, over the seizure of Russia of Crimea and the proxy war in the Ukraine, frustrating as it was for everyone in the West and very bad as it was of the Russians to do it and support it. But Obama certainly made a terrible mistake in declaring, as Sebastian so rightly says, in declaring a red line over the use of chemical weapons in Syria. And I think it is quite likely that at some point in the future, Russian aggression will have to be, the bluff will have to be called, because I think it is quite largely bluff. All I'm pointing out, and I'm certainly not blaming America for what is happening, all that I'm pointing out is that statesmen have to be very, very careful about how to pick their moment to do it, and indeed the location. I'm just not sure air war over Syria is the right place.
Final thought on this one from you, Sebastian. It's a construct or a hypothetical, or I guess a different perspective that a few people have advanced. But are we, by which I guess I mean the West, failing to understand how Russia now sees the world? The comparison has been made that, say, if 25 years ago the United States had collapsed and that bits of it had sheared off, and that Alaska and Texas and California were now independent countries into which Russia or perhaps China had started inserting their forces, how relaxed about the new order would Washington be?
I mean, always fun to do the counterfactual history. Can I just point out that Alaska and Texas aren't populated by people who aren't citizens, who aren't part of the Russian nation, that there were lots of minorities, of course, along the southern border of the Soviet Union as well as the western border,
of course,
who wanted their independence, and I do agree that the West in the 90s was careless with Russia and didn't respect the feelings of a nation which felt very badly bruised, obviously. On the other hand, the Lithuanians and Estonians and indeed the Ukrainians, it was their wish to have their independence, and we can talk about trying to have some sort of arrangement similar to what Finland enjoyed during the Cold War, which was talked about quite in derogatory terms in the West, but I thought suited the Finnish and the Russians well, namely, to stay away from particularly military alliances. I can see that, but But the political alliance that, that these people want to have, these peoples want to have with the West, I think we've got to respect their wishes.
Okay, well, on a related note, one aspect of the current Russia versus the world standoff, which is in some respects reminiscent of the Cold War, is Moscow's enthusiasm for the dissemination of propaganda. This has, however, evolved significantly from earnest broadcasts of tractor production figures and kitschy posters of ruddy-cheeked peasants beaming beatifically at combine harvesters. Russia's 21st century propaganda product is more sophisticated, a Potemkin media landscape in which everything is malleable and nothing is what it seems. George, how dangerous is it? Doesn't any propaganda just appeal to the people who wanted to believe it in the first place?
I think in some sense, propaganda is a test of the nerve of the people it is being played at. If you believe in open circulation of information and that truth it will eventually prevail and out. You also have to have the nerve to wait for that to happen because it doesn't always happen instantaneously. And it's a very bad and nerve-wracking process because bad things can happen while people believe nonsense and lies. And there are, of course, developments in the background, such as the freedom of digital publication, which allow people to circulate nonsense much more easily than they used to be able to do so. It's not that nonsense is new, it's just that it travels at a faster velocity to more people.
It is more bountiful and more efficient nonsense than we had previously.
Precisely so, nicely put. And in this situation, it is very difficult to know what one can do other than to say, one should always try and establish the truth. Evidence is important. Public reason matters. And go on repeating these things. I don't have a magic fix for it. I just have a kind of deep belief that belief in truth is embedded in democratic societies. And eventually, the lies fade, are exposed, turn whatever.
Just to follow that point up briefly, George, there is also the corollary to that, which is advice occasionally dispensed to journalists or people, indeed, interacting with the media at all, which is don't mud wrestle with a pig, you both get filthy and the pig doesn't care. Don't you end up cheapening yourself every time you engage with propaganda or try to countermand propaganda?
I don't think you can make a one-size-fits-all rule. I think there are occasions where you've simply got to say, as calmly as you can, the evidence we have says this. There's a famous story about a French prime minister after the First World War. Somebody was going on about postmodern truth and how you can't really believe anything at all. And he said, well, there are some things we know. For example, I'm fairly sure that Belgium didn't invade Germany. We do know some things. There are some facts. They are the foundation. They are the base. You have to build on that. You can't let it go.
Sebastian, one of the reasons we're talking about this is that Russia's propaganda war has spread, you know, quite deliberately and quite obviously into places like Ukraine, as well as Estonia, Finland, and quite a lot of the former Warsaw Pact. The Czech Republic now officially claims that Russia is building a network of puppet groups in its country, and the Interior Ministry is going to set up a unit to combat this. How is this actually going to work? Because isn't the trouble... You can see how the propaganda operation baits the government here, in that the government makes an official response, the propaganda journal says, well, your government's lying to you, that's what governments do.
I haven't studied the details of the Czech proposal, but I suppose what they would do is try and do what George described, namely give the public and give respectable journalists facts, point out where certain stories come from, point out where how they are being financed. I've just been to Vienna and spoke to a professor of journalism there who's been confronted with a student who researched that famous picture you may remember 2 years ago after the Malaysian jet was mm-hmm. brought down over Ukraine, and someone was Russian-backed rebel was shown in a rather unpleasant way with a teddy bear of one of the kids killed. Now that turns out to come from a film where it's clear that the guy was actually respectful and mourning. But of course, the film came from Russia Today. It's just about pointing out all of those facts. And I think people, you know, we must rely on having having a citizenship which has enough nous to tell truth from propaganda.
George, is there any evidence, however, that that citizenship actually exists? I mean, I'm perpetually depressed and infuriated myself by the number of times you see not just anybody at all sort of retweeting or reposting various, you know, memes especially, or JPEGs of a quote on a misleading background, which, you know, 5 seconds on Google would demonstrate to you our total nonsense. But people who actually call themselves journalists doing this, it is that thing you were mentioned, that social media in particular does. It's that ruthlessly swift and efficient delivery of nonsense, and people will just believe what they want to believe.
Well, you should reassure yourself also, Andrew. You said 5 seconds on Google just now. What you were pointing to was the fact that actually it is faster now to get hold of the accurate information.
Yeah, but I don't know if people are all that interested in it.
Well, there are always downward slides. Whenever you get any new form of communication, firstly you get wild over optimism, then you get pessimism, and you're in the pessimism phase at the moment.
Now, the wild over optimism phase for me was incredibly brief.
Okay, but nevertheless, you're in the pessimism phase now, and I think it's going to level out. When communism collapsed in the Soviet Union and elsewhere, it was astounding how rapidly we discovered that actually people had known the truth for quite a lot of the time. They weren't able to say so. There were very strong reasons they couldn't. But the amount of kind of balance, evidence base, and so on that appeared in all these societies very quickly showed that the kind of DNA of establishing truth and evidence had not been wiped out by regimes that lied for decades on end. People still knew how to tell good from bad and truth from falsehood.
But
it's not as bad as you think.
But those lines have become more blurred now, haven't they? We still live in a period in which it is seen as a perfectly reasonable, among some people, do for Western citizens, Western educated journalists to go and work for RT, or even, you could argue, Western leaders of Her Majesty's opposition to host chat shows on press TV.
Yeah, and of course, and they shouldn't be doing so. But in liberal societies, you will always get the risk that people will want to tell lies and mislead other people. One day, Donald Trump will be reviled and hated for having kidded people into thinking that he's going to bring their jobs back. It is heartrending to hear people who support him in the States on TV interviews saying he's going to bring our jobs back, he's going to get higher wages. None of that is going to happen.
And the NHS isn't getting £350 million a week from the UK leaving the EU.
And it happens
either.
Closer to here as well. You're quite right.
Indeed. We are going to take a short break now on that happy thought. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Sebastian Borger and George Brock. Coming up next, yet another test of Turkish-German relations.
Ever since Justin Trudeau became Prime Minister, Canada has been in the spotlight. And that's just one of the reasons why we dispatched our team north for the November issue, to look at everything from diplomacy to architecture, power players to good food. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In design, we venture into Canada's great outdoors. From the rugged coastline of Nova Scotia to the lakes of Ontario, we meet a cast of architects designing handsome homes that work with the wilderness to form a unique structural language.
In the edit section, we highlight the hidden delights of starting a home in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and dig into the growing food scene in Prince Edward County, Ontario.
The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the team.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and George Brock. Now, no European nation has a relationship with Turkey quite so deep or quite so complex. Germany has for decades been a destination for Turkish guest workers. More recently, a haven for refugees and migrants who have traversed Turkey. And it has also found itself pressured to prosecute a comedian for making fun of Turkey's clearly sensitive president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Complicating matters further, it has this week been admitted that since July's failed coup d'etat in Turkey, 35 owners at least of Turkish diplomatic passports and their families have applied for asylum in Germany. Sebastian, it's probably fairly self-evident why they want asylum in Germany. Do we know who these people are?
We haven't got any details. We don't even know whether it's actually 35 people overall, or whether, as you just said, it's 35 people with diplomatic passports and their families. The Interior Ministry is very reticent about all of those details. Why do they do it? Well, as you say, I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe in population terms, there are even in percentage-wise, there are more Turks in Holland, but certainly the biggest group is in Germany.
It does put Germany in something of a bind, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, if they don't send them... Well, Turkey has not as yet requested their extradition. If that happens, Germany, it would seem to me at least, can't very well send them back to a place where, I've written it down, since the coup d'etat, 32,000 people have now been imprisoned and 100,000 sacked. That's quite a conspiracy, isn't it? 132,000 people in on the one coup d'etat. But of course, if they refuse to send them back, then... That is, here we go again with attempting to keep Turkey in the EU camp. How does Germany play this?
I would hope that there are mature relations between closed doors, and there are diplomats who are able to understand that it's probably best for Turkey not to make a big fuss about this. And it's probably best for Germany not to bang on about the fact that people have sought asylum there. In other words, it's one of those things like we've had the controversy about German parliamentarians in July voting to declare the mass killing of Armenians in the First World War a genocide, which of course always riles the Turks. We've had the issue that the Turks didn't allow German parliamentarians to visit our soldiers in the airbase in Çırlık near Syria, where they've been based for a while now. This kind of tit for tat can only, I think, arise if people want it to arise, and I'm fairly certain that Berlin doesn't want it, and my feeling is that Ankara has sort of stepped back slightly from that kind of confrontation.
George, we were talking earlier about red lines and drawing them around such creatures as Assad and Putin. With that thought in mind, has Germany and perhaps the rest of Europe been a little bit too anxious to accommodate President Erdogan of Turkey?
I think there's almost bound to be something of a reset of relations with Turkey, not only by Germany, but by other countries. They're going to have to say to the Turks, look, your chances of entering the European Union weren't ever very good. Now they're down to zero. Bad luck about that. You got 32,000 conspirators. You could probably spare 35 and just stop worrying about them, and we'll do our best to get on in the future, but don't expect miracles.
Well, okay, finally tonight, and we will stay with Germany, and one does not need to be German or speak German or even just have a German surname to appreciate the rich expressive possibilities of the German language, which has evolved several expressions for states of mind or being for which we might otherwise lack the words. Schadenfreude, Weltschmerz, Sehnsucht, Kopfkino, Zugzwang. Apologies for those pronunciations and indeed for the possibility that none of those actually exist and that I fall for the German equivalent of the Australian drop bear hoax. But the reason we're talking about all this, apart from the joy of just saying those words out loud, is that according to an op-ed by Jochen Bittner in the New York Times, politics on both sides of the Atlantic needs to adopt another German neologism, the Wutbürger. Sebastian, first of all, introduce to us the Wutbürger. Who or what is the Wutbürger?
I really like your pronunciation. It makes me think of my favorite sausage back in Vienna. Käsekreiner, but that's something. Let's leave that aside. Wutbürger is a compound word saying literally saying a rage citizen, a citizen full of rage, and it stems from an essay initially in Der Spiegel magazine a few years ago, where someone analyzed the phenomenon of mainly elderly, mainly conservative, mainly actually better off people getting out into the streets and demonstrating against things which they didn't like. It started off with environmental issue, interestingly enough, particularly in Stuttgart, where the German railways were building a new, or are building a new railway station, in the process of which 150 trees had to go, but of course has now merged very much into the anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner, and anti anything which makes people angst, to use another important German word.
But it's a lovely phrase, and it is just perfect for our times, isn't it, George?
I think
the rebelling, angry, self-pitying white middle classes, which is what we are seeing on both sides of the Atlantic, in both on the left and the right.
I think we should be very grateful for the flexibility and inventiveness of the German language, because it points to something really quite important. In the essay where this was being discussed, the guy says this is about anger in politics, and anger is an important motive. But actually, Wutbürger surely points to something a bit different, which is almost an incapacity to come to terms with modernity. I mean, there is a very strong cultural aspect to this, which we can see in Trumpism.
Corbynism, I would argue as well.
Well, Corbynism,
Brexitism,
Le Penism in France, and we could go on with many isms, but you get the point. And that has a kind of, it has a cultural, not just an economic aspect. Some, as Sebastian was rightly pointing out, some of these people are relatively quite affluent. They just don't like many aspects of the modern world. There is a very high correlation in Britain, for example, between people who voted to leave the European Union and opposition to gay marriage. It's probably not a coincidence. That's cultural, you know, that's the English version of Wutbürger.
Wutbürger. I like it very much. Sebastian, are there other German words that we should be using? I'm very fond myself of Torschlusspanik, which, again, apologies for the pronunciation. This, as I understand it, is gate-shutting panic. This is fear that time is running out.
Time is running out, and it's used. It used to be used mainly for women in their 30s who feel Torschlusspanik because they haven't got children. But of course, it's now equally applied to men. Anyway, yes, you haven't mentioned my favorite word, which went into the English language, namely Blitzkrieg, which I still find in lots of good history books on both sides of the linguistic channel. It is a great language in that sense, and I encourage all and everyone to learn it. Once you got over that initial hurdle, as my English wife keeps pointing out to me, you then can combine all sorts of words for all sorts of new combinations and have fun with it.
Do you have any particular favorites?
Trambahnschienenritzenreinigungsdamenzubehör.
I'm not even going to try and compete with that. It's linguistic Lego, surely. It's having bits, or being able to join them together.
Bricks. Yeah,
stickle bricks, if you like.
Could you run that one past us again, Sebastian, and explain what it means?
Trambahnschienenritzenreinigungsdamenzubehör. It's the utensils of the cleaning lady in Munich, who cleans the tram, the crevices of the tram tracks.
Does this come up in conversation often back
often,
home?
Often, very, all the time.
People are discussing it in pubs all over Germany.
That is a fantastic, how many letters are in that?
I haven't counted, but I guess 35?
35 letters. Any, we've probably got time for you to suggest one more.
Well, you know, just 2 years ago, the parliament in somewhere, Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, I think, abolished a word with 167 words, but I've forgotten what it is, and quite rightly so. Sorry.
Well, on that note, we are out of time, so we must leave here and ponder the various Treppenwitzes we may have perpetrated. Sebastian Borger and George Brock, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's programme. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gal Barnea. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Daniel Giacopelli continues with The Atlantic Shift next, 1900. It's Monocle's business show, The Entrepreneurs, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, though, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.